So, happy, oops, it's still running. Happy St. Patty's Day to you. We did do the Hannah Montana montage earlier. If you missed it, it was by request. And several students seemed to like it from their youth. All right, so happy St. Patty's Day, lecture 18, March 17th, 2022, lecture notes, page 161. I did. So extra credit number 5 closes tonight. Is that right? 5? 5? Mini test 9 and extra credit number 6 open tomorrow, if I have my numbers right. Midterm occurs right after spring break. At least it opens right after spring break, runs for a week. Here we are on the 17th. Next week we have classes. The week after we have spring break. So, nothing interesting there, nothing interesting there. Marketing the news. So, inflation rears its ugly head, which we know about. Inflation is an external factor that we can't control, but it impacts our consumers, it impacts us, and so the four P's of the marketing mix, in particular price, take a hit. Restaurant menu price inflation keeps rising. Restaurant customers in February once again hit with menu price inflation not seen in years. So, the impact of the CREST factors, competition, regulation, legal and political, economic, social and technology. This would be an economic factor, right? The food away from home index, who knew there was such a thing, rose 6.8% over last year, which was the largest 12-month increase since December of 1981. I'm just curious, do you guys eat out? I mean, fast food or restaurants? Not that many. Do you notice? Are you seeing? I mean, are you noticing the price changes? How many are noticing them? How many, meh, I don't really, okay, just curious what the, you guys? Yeah. So limited service meals rose 8% year over year, while full service menu prices grew 7.5% since last year. So here's market research and how this economic factor is affecting one of our four pieces of the marketing mix, price in the marketing mix. The price hikes are unlikely to end within the next few months, although what did the Fed just do that will begin to influence all this? Wakey, wakey, what'd the Fed do? Raised interest rates, and interest rates' purpose, raising it, is to slow the economy and so drive down inflation over the longer term. The price hikes are unlikely. We're going to watch value and value perception, said Wendy CFO Gunther Plush. About 33% of our consumers are making less than $45,000 a year. So we need to make sure that we are striking at the right balance and maintaining the value perception. As we raise our prices up, which we have to do, are people still feeling there's a good value there? So we have to understand our target market consumers, where they are and how they're perceiving our offerings. So far, most brands haven't seen much pushback from consumers, so there is more room to increase prices if necessary. So here's the impact on and from consumers to our corporate strategy. John River, CEO of Florida-based Four River Smokehouse, believes consumer sentiment will inevitably turn sour as the prices continue to go up. His fast casual has tried to get ahead of this future by implementing a value-oriented inflation menu that leverages lower cost of goods sold. So he's adjusting his product, his menu, items to the current environment to try to avoid future problems through planning. Probably one of the most strategically important things a restaurant needs to do today is to look out 6 months and 12 months to start making plans and changes now. Otherwise, if you manage your business from a reactionary perspective, reacting to what's going on in the environment like we used to do for years, you're going to get caught when the change in consumer behavior and attitude happens. So there's the importance of strategic planning and forecasting a bit into the future. In the U.S. overall, inflation rose 7.9% in February, setting the highest mark since 1982. Again, a CREST factor on the economy. Barbie is quite active these days. She's hosting her very first Shoppable Dream live stream with Walmart. I didn't know, she doesn't look 63 years old, does she? She's doing okay. So in her 63 years, Barbie has a dream house, a dream car, which is technically a dream Corvette, a dream camper, and a dream plane. Now she's getting her very own dream live stream. Well, not actually the name of the broadcast. The Mattel-owned toy brand is teaming up with the live stream platform Talk Shop Live. Anybody know Talk Shop Live? Is that a thing you know? Okay. To pay homage to Women's History Month with a live show that will kick off tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So given that we're paying homage to Women's History Month, there's a bit of social responsibility in marketing. It will showcase two collections, Barbie's Inspiring Women series, which pays tribute to incredible heroines of their time via 10 dolls, including Maya Angelou, Ida Wells, Helen Keller, Rosa Parks, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Barbie's career dolls, which includes a pediatrician, a pop star, and a pasta chef. So products in the marketing mix and a bit about our promotion. Walmart, the partner for this, which recently teamed up with TalkShop Live for live stream commerce, is the presenting sponsor and will fulfill any resulting orders. So this is channel relationships, channel distribution, and of course, e-commerce. Viewers can access the live stream on walmart.com/live or via Mattel's TalkShop Live channel. Shoppers are going to be able to learn about and revisit some of the most pivotal female-led moments in history and be inspired by what these women have accomplished. Viewers will be doing more than buying products. They will be shopping the experience and connecting with the Barbie brand on a deeper level through live conversations with the designer of Barbie. So creating a customer experience, not just selling product, and developing consumer relationships for our fan base. TalkShop Live also does live streams for Walmart's partner brands, which include P&G, as well as Barbie's parent Mattel. According to TalkShop Live, its video player allows customers to purchase products within the videos, removing the friction in the path to purchase with a system that's embeddable on almost any site, so making it easy for the consumers to shop. I am either going to menopause here or, oops, I can't do that. I'm either having a bit of a hot flash or it's warm in here. I saw you up there. You were waving. It's warm, right? Yeah, it's warm. It's not just me. So. A little stuffy, or it's just me being stuffy. But anyhow, I'm taking off some clothes. So there we go. Powerade encourages international star athletes to take a breath and pause. Athletes' mental well-being and the pressure they are placed under took the spotlight last year when U.S. gymnast Simone Biles withdrew from the competition during last year's Olympics. Japanese tennis player Naomi Osaka, a top-tier tennis player, similarly withdrew from Wimbledon to take personal time last summer. The pressure to perform and win can be highly intense. An issue, of course, of societal concern for athletes. Some of you guys are either Kent State athletes or high school athletes, any athletes. So you guys know what they're talking about, the pressure. This is an issue that sports drink brand Powerade is supporting through a campaign that features major athletes, including Biles, Premier League soccer manager Antonio Conte, the Olympic star gold diver Tom Daley, as they take a pause to relax and enjoy unexpected hobbies such as knitting and dance. Also featured are former NBA stars Chris Webber and Jason Williams. So we're doing a bit of a social responsibility ad campaign. We're using celebrities. The Pause is Power campaign began to run on TV in the U.S. this week during the NCAA March Madness Selection Sunday telecast, and aims to convey the need for laughter, reflection, community, and recovery for athletes, challenging the win-at-all-costs mentality that they develop more often than not. A bit of humor in their advertising.
Listen up, guys.
Our biggest problem right now, we are missing pauses.
You mean passes?
No, pauses. The secret to winning is to pause.
Bring it up!
Time out! Let's take a break.
Into the bunny hole.
Down the big tree.
You like it, Tom?
Now you're talking. Gorgeous work, Antonio.
I'm taking a step back.
What's the reason?
Sometimes you gotta stop to be an actual human.
Take a minute to celebrate, huh?
420.
okay. You'll get it tomorrow.
So either it resonates with you or don't. I liked it a lot. The international campaign will also include digital, social, and out-of-home assets as Gatorade tries to convey the importance of life away from winning. So we're seeing global marketing campaign. We're seeing their campaign theme. To develop the Pause is Power campaign, it was inspired by the stance taken by Bowles. The Powerade brand team gathered insights from young people across the U.S., Mexico, South Africa, Germany, and Australia, and used their perspectives to shape the campaign strategy. These insights will continue to inform community-level activations around the world. So marketing research for action and global marketing. Instead of focusing solely on physical performance anchored in sport, we're celebrating the importance of the mindset, the combination of body and mind, and bringing to the culturally relevant Pause is Power message, not just to athletes, but to all who embrace a sports-infused lifestyle by using what we call humor with substance. So again, humor in advertising. The competition will, a competition will also run until April 5th under the Pause is Power platform, offering 20 North American student athletes the opportunity to win $10,000 for their summer off season to allow them to recharge. All you student athletes who raise your hand, go check that out. See if you can win 10 grand to support your summer. So that's a bit of a sales promotion. So we pick up with lecture notes, page 161, page 298 in the textbook, chapter 11, Managing Successful Products, Services, and Brands. So we were talking about the all-important concept of the product life cycle. Products don't go out there and succeed forever. Some are fads, in and out pretty quickly. Some have extended life cycles, extended maturity stages, but eventually we presume they will follow the trend and eventually decline. So refrigerators, Coke, long maturity stages of the product life cycle. So the product life cycle seems to be getting shorter for most products. Why? Because there's a lot of me too products that come out pretty quickly. And in part, that's related to the idea of technology being replicatable. And also, as new technology comes out, then those products that were new a little bit ago no longer are new, right? New technology moves in. So it shrinks the product life cycle of anything that comes out compared to what it used to be. The product life cycle can be affected by a variety of things. For example, the category and its use. Retin-A. Do you guys know that name, Retin-A, as a user product? So Retin-A originally came out, and it was a cream that you put on your face to help with acne. Acne, not acne. Acne is a grocery store. Acne is a little pimple thing. So it helped with that. Well, that sort of ran its course. But they discovered, interestingly, that Retin-A also, when you used it, cleans up wrinkles. Whoa, that was an unintended thing for teens, but a lot of older adults were interested in that. And once they found out that it was a wrinkle reduction product, they were able to expand that product life cycle with this new product category. So how to use Retin-A for wrinkles and why it works. So the product category and how it's used can affect a product life cycle. Differences in geographic markets can affect a product life cycle. We've said before that Starbucks probably doesn't need a whole bunch more domestic stores, right? They still can expand globally. Likewise, KFC, McDonald's, they're pretty well saturated geographically in the U.S. You know, they're not growing really wildly here. But they're still growing in places like India, China. We'll ignore Russia. So geographic markets, whether it's domestically, different areas of the country, different regions, different cities, or internationally, can affect the product life cycle. Also, the characteristics of the target market itself relate to the product life cycle. So we talked a little bit ago about that early stage of the product life cycle when it's in the introductory stage. And we asked, who in the world is going to spend all that extra money to get a flat screen TV, a 3D printer? Who's going to spend all those bucks? And the answer is the innovators, which in general are said to be about 2.5% of the overall population are innovators. They want new things in the category they're interested in, fashion, cars, printers, technology, whatever. And they're willing to and can spend those dollars. So the innovators, venturesome, high educated, use multiple information sources, and they want that new stuff in the introduction stage of the product life cycle. As we move on a bit, we move to the early adopters. These are leaders in social settings, They have slightly above average education, but they get in before the masses get in. After the innovators, they're waiting a little bit, but then they get in. So that's going to, that grouping for you is going to affect that curve. The early majority and late majority, you can see each are about 34% of the overall population. The early majority, lay back, hold back, check it out, see if it's working. They want to see what other people are doing. As that thing moves into the growth stage, they're going to get on board. And then we have the late majority. They're skeptical at first. They have below average social status. They're worried about how this thing is going to play out. They might be in the mature stage of the product life cycle. And finally, you get the laggards as a group, about 60% of the population. They're way slow to get in on whatever the thing is. They don't have a lot of financial resources. They fear debt. Their neighbors and friends are information sources as opposed to leading magazines in the field, and they're going to hang back as well. So where do you stand with these different groups? Are they interested in your product, and where are they in terms of the progress of your product life cycle? Successful marketers need to do well at predicting the shape and the timing of their product life cycle. Is it going to be a fad? You better be planning for that in terms of ordering manufacturing, ordering inventory, pricing your product. You're going to be in and out. Or is it longer? And then recognizing what stage they are in. Are you in the introduction stage, growth stage, maturity stage, decline stage? Because that does affect your strategy, how you do your marketing mix. So you have to recognize what stage of the product cycle you're in and then adapt to that with your marketing mix. How? Well, we just talked last time about those strategies. Now, when do you enter a new market? Are you going to be a first mover? Are you going to come up with the first version of the thing? Are you going to be a pioneer? So as a pioneer, of course, you've got to make people aware of what's going on. Break into that market. Amazon.com was not the first seller of books online, but Amazon.com was the first significant company to make an entrance into the online book market. And I don't know if you heard the company or not, but they moved well beyond books to be successful. So they built that first mover approach into a massive success. eBay, they were a first mover, and that allowed them to dominate the online auction space for quite a long time. How many of you guys have used eBay to buy or sell stuff? Okay, what else do you use other than eBay to buy and sell stuff in a bid situation? I don't know. It's eBay, right? They got to be the first mover and it's worked really well for them. So you have to decide what your strategy is going to be. An imitation strategy can be better. You don't want to run that risk. You want to let somebody else do all that work. And you're going to hope that they don't become the premier offerer of whatever the thing is. And you're going to come in later. For example, the original diet no-calorie soda was called NoCal. It was a brand out of New Jersey. Anybody ever hear of the NoCal brand? No. They were first mover, but it didn't work out. Coke and Pepsi came along after and were successful taking over that marketplace. So there's no single right answer. You have to do strategic planning to figure out what's going to work best for you, pioneering or imitation. As we grow on the rise, we are going to have to pay attention to what's going on. So here is the early video games that we introduced in the 1970s. What brand would that have been? Atari? Yeah, I think I have one of those at home. There you go, the Atari symbol. So as you go through the rise, competition is going to come in. What does that mean? We already talked about what it means. You're going to have to differentiate your product from competition. Also, in this case, technology is coming along as well. So we now see over time technological leapfrogs. We've got more video, more audio, more graphics while controlling prices. So a long way down the rise, we've got the Xbox 360, the Sony PlayStation, the Nintendo Wii. Where's the Atari home system today? They went through a what?
They develop games now. They don't develop
exactly
games.
Right. So they shifted over time. They shifted from their initial mover advantage. They were really big in the day.
Much with, like Sega as well.
Sega. And so over time, what happens? They shift their strategy. Others come in and are successful. So how do you be successful in that marketplace? In this case, competition came in with these advantages. In the maturity stage, everybody knows what you are. The question is, what are you going to do to stay successful? Well, we had that example that we saw from Fred Hunt over at Sherwin-Williams. I mean, paint is pretty mature as a product category, right? We're not seeing big, exciting things in paint. But they managed to get some attention. Dutch Boy was is a subdivision of Sherwin-Williams. And their packaging innovation with this new can of paint did get attention. So here we are in the Sherwin-Williams site, and here they are with their new paint can. I did hear a while when I was chatting with Fred that they had come up with a new product. I haven't followed it to see if it worked or not. Have you ever gone to someone's apartment or home and it stinks, it smells from either food or cats or whatever? They don't notice it. Nose blindness, but you notice it. And so the idea was they would combine with Arm & Hammer baking soda that sucks up odors. And what's the biggest thing you have in your house? Walls. You would paint your walls with Arm & Hammer baking soda, Sherwin-Williams paint, and it would absorb and hold the odors, was the concept. I thought it was pretty good as a concept. I haven't seen it on the shelves, but that's a bit of innovation. If it worked, maybe it didn't work. I haven't seen a lot of new stuff in paint, so that was a little innovation in the maturity stage of the product life cycle that set them apart from competition and got some additional interest for their product. Surviving the decline stage is pretty tough, right? Most people who are interested in you in this category went away by now, so it's a pretty big challenge. Do we know what that is? What that is a can of? What is it? Condensed milk. How do you happen to know, other than it's up there? How do you know condensed milk? Because you make pies. So condensed milk was around from the Civil War days because there was no refrigeration. Most of us these days have, you have a refrigerator, right? Most of us have refrigerators, but this is no longer why it's used. So what are you going to do to make it stay from the Civil War days? Market it as a special treat to make pies or holiday treats or whatever. They've managed to stay around well into the decline stage of their product life cycle. So promoted as a key ingredient in making various treats easily and throughout the year. Bada bink, bada boom, we're still out for that niche market. How many of the rest of you use condensed milk? 1.5, 2.5, all right? Not everybody else. We're a niche market. We do something special with it. So they've managed to stick around. During the decline stage, what can we do? Well, first of all, we better ensure that our marketing and production programs are as efficient as possible. We're not having big growth. Excuse me. Hey, Tom, I'm in front of a class of 65 people and recording for another 400. I'll call you back later. Bye-bye. I will turn off my phone, which I always ask you to do. St. Patty's Day. So you have to be sure that you're being efficient and effective because there's not a lot of revenue flooding in. Yes? If you have various things that you can cut out that aren't bringing in, you know, that are bringing the least revenue, prune those unprofitable sizes, those unprofitable models. Of course, it'll decrease your sales, but they weren't making you money anyhow. You were losing money on them. So the sales may decrease, but your profits will increase. Run the product out, if that's the strategy, to squeeze out whatever final profits that you can get. Or if you can find a way, revitalize the thing. Come up with something that's interesting, a new promotional strategy to make pies and treats throughout the year. A new geographic territory that still has an interest in you, something new to revitalize it. All right. On to the idea of, since we're talking about managing brands, products, and services, we should talk about brands a little bit. What is a brand from our perspective? A brand is a living business asset. It is the business strategy that your company has brought to life across all of the consumer touch points, all of the times that they get to see you, which it properly manages, does create identification for your company in the mind of the consumer, differentiation from the competition, and presuming you have something worthwhile, value. So the brand does all of those things. Here we hear Joe Frampton of a well-known company, Interbrand, talking about this concept.
So if you do actually concentrate on understanding how your brand creates value for your organization, it can be very, very successful for you over time. Because these things don't happen in a heartbeat. Because you're dealing with people's emotions, their connections with you, how they feel about you, and you have to deliver, of course. So there we are in the age of value, and then during that period of time, something very interesting happened to the way that people see brands within the context of their organisation. Increasingly, the brand becomes effectively the business strategy brought to life. And this is the way you have to think nowadays if you are ever going to achieve that holy grail of marketers right now, the seamless connected experience. Because unless the brand influences the behaviour and actions of every part of your organisation, there is no way you are ever going to be able to deliver that. So if you remember one thing from this, brands are business strategy brought to life. Simple stuff. If you can encourage your organisation to think like that, and if you think like that, and if you can encourage your colleagues in the rest of your organisation to think like that, you will be successful. You will make a difference. But it's, unfortunately, things have moved on again. So there we are, happily in the age of value, understanding our brand create value, and then we approach this thing called the age of experience. This is where we are now. So this is real stuff. It's not just us making it up. It's based upon empirical information on the views of CEOs, CMOs, CTOs, and everyone else who's got a C at the front of their title. So we enter the age of experience, and who better to sort of demonstrate that than that? But the big thing that really happened, of course, was this. The power is shifting. People have said to me, and I'm sure they've said to you, and you may even said it yourself along the time, that the customer owns the brand. The customer doesn't own the brand. The customer dictates what the brand should be. Because they're the ones who have expectations. They're the ones who have beliefs about what they might experience when they come into contact with your organisation. They don't own it. But they are a massive influence on it.
So I don't know if you reflect on this or if it's resonating you if you're watching Cats on video just now. But hopefully from our course together, what you've already clicked on was the terms he used, the age of value, then the age of experience, then the idea of consumer beliefs and expectations. Hopefully, after what we've been talking about for however many weeks, those things are beginning to click in ways maybe they didn't before. So he's talking about these things that we're talking about from the real world. The word brand is comprehensive. Brands are used both to identify a seller and to differentiate your product from the competition. So it's a comprehensive term. It has some different meanings depending on which context you're thinking about it in. Brand name, those are the words and the letters and the numbers that can be vocalized, that you can say. So, Pier 1 Imports, right? Brand name. Procter & Gamble, Nordstrom, Hugo Boss, Victoria's Secret, all brand names, words, letters, and numbers that can be vocalized. Brand mark is a symbol or a design or a color or special lettering that's identified with the brand that obviously the marketer has to spend time, remember we talked about learning, associating this image with the brand to make it make sense. So what brand does that represent? Nike. In fact, that they've been so successful with that the image itself has a name. It's the Nike swoosh. Okay, that's pretty good marketing, right? So what about this one on the left? Firefox? Mercedes-Benz? Shell Oil?
Apple?
Pepsi? And that's an extinct sports team. I don't know if you've heard it or not. Anybody know what that used to be? The Cleveland Indians, but of course now I got to update my slide. So these have worked. Now you can also have a word mark. A word mark is the idea of mixing together colors and script, for example. So I think we all recognize Google, Coca-Cola, that red script, even when it's in a language that doesn't use this alphabet, still is familiar. People still know what it is. Microsoft. And then you have the idea of, say, the recognizability of the bottom image on the right, which I think we all pretty much know wherever we are in the world. That's been pretty successful. Starbucks versus a successful local store, right, in the same business, Scribbles Coffee. Who's been to Scribbles? They make pretty good coffee. So Scribbles Coffee. So obviously there's different levels of success with this idea of word mark. So this is also known as logo. It's also known as logotype. So you'll see different folks using different words to mean more or less the same thing, as often happens in the real world and in business. Trademark is the legal protection of a brand. We learned in business in the news, marketing in the news, whichever one we were talking about, the dangers when a country decides to ignore trademark, meaning anybody can use your hard-won brand image, your logo, your name, and sell whatever they want under it. That's an unusual situation that we have right now, right? When a country is going away from trademarks. But companies strive vigorously to protect their trademarks for obvious reasons. It's their brand reputation. Anybody know what that was? The World Wrestling Federation. They're not the World Wrestling Federation anymore. Why not? Because the World Wildlife Foundation said, we have the trademark on WWF. Now, you would argue with me that no one in their right mind is going to confuse that cute panda organization with a bunch of bulky wrestlers, but they won. World Wildlife Foundation won this dispute. And what did WWF become? WWE, World Wrestling Entertainment. So they strove to protect their brand image under the statement, properly, that we have registered this trademark. We have spent money getting people to know who we are. You can't use it. In 2017, the Cavaliers introduced two new logos. It took 18 months to come up with the two logos, making sure they had the trademarks and color schemes all set and legal, along with it appealing to the fans. It took 18 months to come up with the new logos. So leading brands with presumably things that we recognize. Apple, Amazon, Samsung, IBM, Google, Microsoft, Coca-Cola. And notice the all-important information that we are registered, trademarked. We're making a big deal out of the fact that we are a trademarked and registered brand. So what happens as the environment changes, as the social values change around brands, which they do over time, as we know, and we have a situation like Black Lives Matter and ethnic sensitivity. So brands create identification, differentiation, and value, but what happens when the social norms, one of those crust factors, competition, regulation, legal and political, economic, social, and technology, you know that, right? Brands need to adjust. So Quaker Oats is ending the Aunt Jemima breakfast brand. Mars will change its Uncle Ben's name. Congra Brands, Mrs. Butterworth's, will undergo a brand review. Dreyer's Ice Cream announced it would change the marketing and name of its Eskimo Pie brand after nearly 100 years, since the term Eskimo is considered derogatory by the native people of the Arctic. So we have to be attentive to the things that change in our environment, that affect our consumers, that affect us, even in our brand names. Cream of Wheat, which is owned by B&G Foods, also announced that it would conduct a review of its current packaging, not the name so much, but the packaging. Washington's NFL team, formerly known as the Washington Redskins, was called itself the Washington Football Team. Has it adapted a new name yet? Not yet. And the Cleveland Indians have consulted with Native American groups as the team changed its name for the first time since 1915 to the Guardian. So brands need to adapt to these changing social norms or face repercussions, boycotts, decrease sales from consumers. So why brand? Why bother? It sounds like it's a big hassle to me. During the recent pandemic, which you may remember, there were not typical products on many shelves. So my wife goes out to do the shopping, comes back with those. Whatever those are, they're new and improved. Unbranded muffins, English muffins. They weren't Thomas's, I'll tell you that. I have no confidence in that particular new and improved what to mean anything. There's no brand name with it. What? Yes, exactly so. So for me, that wasn't a big seller. Of course, I wanted the English muffin. That's all that was there. But still. So branding does provide value and confidence. Ah, there we go. Thomas's. Even if they're not new and improved, they're Thomas's. I like them. So for consumers, brands help to identify the product or the service. It helps to let you know what that quality will be and assure that you'll get whatever that quality is next time. We would all agree that we don't get the same quality of hamburgers at a 5-star restaurant as we do at Wendy's. But in both cases, we know what we're getting. They're different. We're fine with them being different because it's what we expect. And it's consistent. At least it should be. Makes shopping easier and faster. How would you like to have to go down the cereal aisle and everything just said cereal? And you had to read it to see what it was. Apple Rick's cereal, a real product, but what? Versus Fruit Loops. I know what I'm getting. Makes shopping easier. So for consumers, it does all of these things. There's a generic can of tomato sauce. Tell you what, give me Heinz. I prefer it. For sellers, the people that are doing the branding, it does provide a focus for their promotion. I'm not sure, too sure what your focus for the promotion on the right-hand tomato sauce can is. Buy tomato sauce. It allows for recognition and differentiation. Heinz, Hunt's, tomato sauce. And it helps reduce the importance of price comparisons when everything's sort of generic. We don't know what it is, what its quality is, who's selling it. What do we go by? The only thing left is pretty much price. We don't want that as a marketer. We want you to be willing to spend a little more for our special product. So it makes sense for both consumers and for sellers. Now, are the benefits generated financially for a company worth the costs? Well, the answer, of course, is in many cases, yes. Coty paid Procter & Gamble $12.5 billion to acquire Wella Hair Care, Clairol Hair Coloring, and CoverGirl makeup brands. Somebody thought those brands are worth something. So yeah, in many cases, it is certainly worth the cost. Back to Inner Brands, they do a annual, although I can't always get video from the annual, commentary on the best global brands. This is them talking about the best global brands from 2019, the last time I could get it.
Welcome back to Squawk Box. Big Tech dominating a new report on the most valuable global brands. Joining us right now to talk about all of this is Daniel Binns. He's the CEO of the New York office of Interbrand, which puts this list together every year. So who is at the top this year relative to last year?
Apple again for the seventh year in a row. With a valuation of almost $230 billion. So super powerful process for
Before
Amazon.
Before we get really deep on this, just the methodology that you pursue.
It's basically a threefold thing. So we look at the financial performance of the company and its future earnings. We then look at the role of brand, which is basically what we determine to be the amount of the customer decision making, which is built by brand versus functional attributes of the company. And then what we defined as the strength of the brand. So of the tables, $2.1 trillion worth of value in the table overall. $800 billion comes from tech brands. So tech brands do dominate the sector. I mean, they offer incredible service. So as a customer, you're making that value exchange and you're determining that I'm prepared to give you my data in exchange for the amazing products and services that I get.
And then you have more classic companies like McDonald's.
Who would, you know, have done an incredible job of renovating their experience. They're continuing to grow. They're starting to think about the menu in a different way. So we're seeing that brand continue to get relevant. And what we see is that the companies that do well on the list are those that are endlessly responding to customer needs and therefore managing to stay relevant. It's tough because the world is moving very fast. Customer expectation is moving faster than most companies can keep up. So the strongest brands are the ones that are able to transcend, make what we call an iconic move, and sort of shift from the customer expectation.
We were just talking about IBM earnings.
Yeah.
They're number 12 on this list?
Yeah, they've gone down this year. I mean, it's been obviously a tough year for IBM. within that business service. Is that about today? Is that about the history of it? What is it?
It's about today. I mean, brands built with, you know, over years and years, and the equity that's built into them is something which is invested in and nurtured.
How's the NBA?
Finally, Disney's at the end of the list there?
Yeah, number 10. Well, it's into the top 10 for the first time.
Which it was not there before.
It was not there before.
That's so interesting. So because I would have thought that brand actually would have actually been higher on the list on a relative basis.
Yeah, no, it is. It's into the top 10. Obviously, the Disney Plus promise is really powerful. The aggregation, all that content, lots of discussion around Netflix this morning.
Daniel, thank you. Appreciate it.
I love it when the real world talks about what we're talking about. Relevant brands endlessly respond to consumer needs because we have to understand, discover, and fulfill consumer needs, wants, and desires. I think we've said that. And customer expectations move fast. We have to adapt in the whitewater rapids world in which we exist. All right, so here's the update. I couldn't get a video on it. Of 2021's rankings for the best global brands, Apple's still at the top. Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Samsung, Coca-Cola, Toyota, Mercedes-Benz, McDonald's, and Disney still at number 10 in 2021. Good for them. And then the rest of the top 20 are there for you. All right, so if brands are so effing important, why isn't everything branded? Well, there are reasons for that too, right? Branding brings responsibilities that some manufacturing companies don't want. Thank you. Don't want it. For example, as we talked about, brands require expensive promotion. It's not inexpensive to develop that new brand, get it distributed, market it, promote it. I'll let you do that. I'll make it. You sell it. Brands require maintenance of product quality because your name is on it. Now, I would presume if you're selling it through somebody else, you also have to maintain product quality for them, but it's not for you. Branding does not make sense, by the way, if the product itself can't be physically differentiated from other products. What's the branding purpose? So we said this before. What's your favorite brand of wheat? Wheat? It's wheat. Of clothespins. It's pretty generic, although maybe if you're really into hanging clothes up on a clothesline, there's different brands, but I don't know about it. So there's some brands that just, some products that just don't make very much sense to spend a lot of time promoting, differentiating, and spending money on. So a good brand name, if you decide that you need a brand name, has some characteristics. Some brand names are so good that they actually contribute to the success of the product. That's pretty cool. For example, as a consumer, if your car battery dies, you're a little upset. You want a new car battery. How about one with a name? Die Hard. That sounds like it would be pretty good. But what's the challenge of a good brand name? Finding a good brand name. We're running out of name possibilities. There are over 30,000 products launched every year. Man, there are only so many words in the English dictionary. you can't call your brand by the. So we're running out of words, right? So what do? Well, we get fancy. We combine words with numbers to make a brand name. So Net2Phone, 7UP, 3M, Chanel No. 5, Philips 66, 9 Lives, WD-40, 7-Eleven. Obviously, we're getting a little creative to make something that we can register, trademark, and promote around. So that might help us out. Or we create new or meaningless words. And then, of course, we have to imbue them with value. We have to go through that process, that learning process, to connect the brand with value. When the very early Razor, Motorola Razor, came out, the ads to me were vague. I didn't know the term Razor, and I didn't know what the heck they were marketing. I really didn't. I'm a marketer, and I couldn't figure out what the ad was about. Eventually, over time, they built meaning into the word. Exxon, they did a huge search to make sure that it was unique in any language of the world, that it couldn't be confused with anything else. Novartis, Skype, Google, Lexus. A good brand name, if you can make it do it, could suggest the benefits of the product or the use of the product. For example, Simmons Beauty Rest Mattress. Beautiful rest. Sounds good to me. Or should be easy to pronounce, to spell, to remember. When you think laundry detergents, what leaps to mind? Tide. Tide. Oh, yep. How many people thought Tide? Okay? I guess there are a bunch of others out there too. Tide, though, is pretty easy to spell, pretty easy to pronounce, pretty easy to remember. And as far as I know, it's still the number one in the market. It's also cleans clothes well. Easy to pronounce, easy to spell, easy to remember. Is distinctive, stands out, which might run a little bit against being easy to pronounce, spell, and remember. But Exxon, pretty distinctive. They did research to make sure it was distinctive. Unlike that, whether or not it's actually true, I think I used the example before of the Chevy Nova that in Spanish supposedly meant doesn't go. That had a meaning they didn't want. This was distinctive, didn't have any other meanings, stands out. And of course, that can be registered and legally protected. That would be why it took 18 months for the Cavaliers to come up with a new logo, at least that's part of it. Is adaptable to product line additions. That's an interesting thought. We aren't always sure what our future will bring, right? So we create a brand name around what we're doing right now. And then we decide we're going to expand. Is that going to work? So for example, if you're Southwest Airlines, I'm not sure what you can expand into. Now, they probably aren't worried about that. They're probably doing okay as airlines, but they're not going to expand very well. How about Virgin? We know the brand Virgin? Yeah, what do they sell? Phones? Is that what you said, phones?
Yeah, phones.
Phones? Anything else they sell? We don't know Virgin that well. Well, let's take a look at what they've done with the Virgin brand name. It's adaptable. They sell Virgin Records, Virgin Media, Virgin Mobile, Virgin Money, Virgin Games, Virgin Atlantic, Virgin Hotels, Virgin Holidays, Virgin Care. And so they've done a pretty, they have a name that they've made adaptable to almost any product line they want to get into. It has no particular tie. Let's hear from a company that is an expert in creating brands.
I'm David Plasek. I'm the founder and president of Lexicon Branding. Our company has come up with some of the world's most well-recognized names. So there's an area of linguistics called sound symbolism, which really says the individual letters of the alphabet, the sound of those letters, evoke certain qualities. So Swiffer is a cleaning product. We said, well, what is the sound of cleaning products? We describe things as sweeping and swiping and mopping. So we started to mimic those sounds, and you go from sweep to swipe. That's not that attractive, so then we put an F on there, and then it becomes Swift. Then we look at legal situations and trademark clutter, and we put an E on it, and then finally we move to an ER.
Stop cleaning. Start Swiffering.
There are five types of names. There's real words. The next block over would be real words that stem from Greek, Latin, and Sanskrit. Then there's compressions, like taking a word and shrinking it down. Then there's constructed words. And then finally, coin solutions. The first thing we do is we try to understand what the story is. We are, as humans, hardwired for story. We don't have to describe it. We don't have to tell people what the product is. But we do have to tell people, hey, listen to us. BlackBerry's an interesting story. They had tried for a number of weeks to develop really what were descriptive names with things like Easy Mail and Pro Mail. They were rejected from a trademark standpoint. We did some research. What we noticed about email and messaging and texting was that people's blood pressure went up. Let's create some names that decrease it. We started pursuing things that relax you. Someone wrote strawberry for summer. Our head linguist, he wrote a little note saying, this is too slow, too long, and underneath it, he wrote blackberry. Coca-Cola's Dasani. Coke came to us under a lot of pressure. They weren't in the bottled water business. So we were able to identify between Mexico and Canada over 900 brands of bottled water. Most of them descriptive, Poland Springs, Aquafina, things like that. And so we had a tremendous trademark barrier to overcome because everyone is trying to be descriptive. Let's create a coin solution. We put S-A-N, the Latin root for health, right in the middle of the word, not in the beginning, because that would lead to sanitary and sanitation and things like that. And then we built letters around that, and now it's Dasani, right? So it's easy to pronounce, has a great pattern, ends with a nice slim I, because people drinking water want to be healthy. We're all about being distinctive, being memorable.
Who knew so much thought and expertise goes into creating the brand names with such symbolism as I for slim?
I'm David Platt.
Yes, David. So we have a lot of money spent in this stuff. We'd like to protect it. The problem is, of course, among other things, we have counterfeiting going on, product counterfeiting. Intellectual property theft costs companies $600 billion, probably more, annually, and costs at least 1 million jobs in the U.S. For example, pirates often copy drugs and medicines by substituting other ingredients that are cheaper and untested. In many cases, such ingredients are water or talcum powder. These may not be harmful if they're taken through the mouth, but they can kill if they are injected. Somebody buys your drug or medicine, inject it, and die. And it wasn't yours. Nonetheless, what do you think that does to your brand reputation, your brand image? It's not good. Counterfeit washing powder, laundry soap, for instance, can be harmful to the skin. Counterfeit toys have been known to harm children. They break apart, kids swallow them, they have lead paint in them. Counterfeit automobile parts, such as brake pads, tires, and shock absorbers, have led to failure and accidents. You go out and you think you're getting genuine GM products, and they're not. So it occurs in a large number of categories. So what do we have here? We've got fashion, the fake and the real product. We've got soy sauce, fake and real. Some countries in the world take this very seriously. We, I've said before, I used to take students on student trips to different countries of the world, and Switzerland was very laissez-faire about allowing people to walk into their country off the plane. There was like really no customs check or anything. It always surprised me. You just walked in. Wow, we're in Switzerland. And so I've done this many times, and I'm walking through, and all of a sudden, a student who's right behind me isn't behind me anymore. Where's the student? Okay, you guys wait here. I'm going to go see what happened to the student. Customs pulled the student over. The student had bought, it doesn't matter, I'm going to say a Calvin Klein knockoff, and it was brand new to them. On the plane over, it was so cheap that the plastic, which Calvin Klein is not plastic, ripped, and the customs agent noticed it on the way in. Pulled the student over and said, tell you what, you can either take a very large fine and take that into our country where we don't allow rip-offs, counterfeit products, or you can dump all your stuff into this black trash bag and come into the country. She chose the trash bag. So different countries of the world are really watching for this counterfeit stuff. They take it really seriously. Counterfeit toys, I said, have been known to harm children. This is an example of counterfeit medicine for cancer and treatment of anemia for cancer patients. The original product had quite a different amount of the product compared to the original one, so 40,000, whatever that measurement is, versus 2,000. And so it was actually harming these poor cancer patients. The World Health Organization says that globally, not necessarily in the U.S., as much as 10% of medicines aren't real. They are counterfeited using your brand name. Hardly a good thing. It happens in all medicine, it happens in high tech, it happens in fashion. Amazon is well aware of this. It's tackling its counterfeit problem by letting brands themselves delete knockoff brands. So Amazon is taking a new approach to its counterfeit problem by putting brands in control of expunging knockoff products on its Amazon site. The company announced a new program called Project Zero that will let brands themselves delete the fake listings. So we're protecting our brand reputation, image, and revenue through our channel partner, Amazon. Like other tech platforms, Amazon has long struggled with how to deal with false or misleading information on its site. But when users post fake products on Amazon, they can have lasting impacts on the brands that they're trying to knock off, like pressuring the real brand to lower their prices in order to compete with the fake versions of themselves. Ouch, that's not good. Removing fakes has proven to be complicated for Amazon, and sometimes the system backfires. One real store on Amazon's marketplace was suspended shortly before Amazon's 2017 Prime Day because of a fake claim of intellectual property violation by a non-existent law firm. So the issue is, of course, complicated. Now Amazon hopes to boost its effort to eliminate counterfeits by putting the power directly in the hands of the brands that it invites into their Project Zero program. Amazon will combine self-service counterfeit removal for brands with automated scans of logos and trademarks on its website and unique codes on physical items that will help confirm authenticity. Brands who join the program will be able to delete a listing that it deems as being fake without reporting it to the Amazon first to ensure it's removed more quickly. And obviously the logic is you aren't going to delete your own product sale from Amazon. You're cutting your own sales, so you're only going to do it for fake sales. Amazon said this information will be used to strengthen its own automated processes. So we're trying to build good relationships with our channel partners. We're using technology to help out. Our aim is that customers always receive authentic products when shopping on Amazon. Project Zero builds on our long-standing work and investments in this area. It allows brands to work with us to leverage our combined strengths to move quickly at a scale to drive counterfeits to zero. So providing real value to our consumers. We also need to, of course, find good ways to have laws that deal with this. So U.S. Customs seized $1.3 billion in counterfeit goods in 2020. What are the most counterfeited products in America? Of course, it'll vary by year. Fake trademarked logos and tags. So it's not that it's the polo on the shirt, but it's got a tag hanging down from the shirt claiming polo or whatever. Computers and accessories. Optical media products such as games and DVDs and CDs that are not real. Handbags and wallets valued at more than $200 million. A fake Coach bag is often valued in the hundreds of dollars. The value of some counterfeit Hermes bags is in thousands of dollars lost to the actual producer. Pharmaceuticals, we've talked about. Personal care products. Watches and jewelry. Hey, you want to see my Rolex watch that I got in the corner for 50 bucks? Rolex. Not. Estimated value of $581 million. Like other luxury goods, watches and jewelry are especially vulnerable to trademark infringement. A replica can serve as a status symbol for those who can't afford the price tag of the original luxury good, but of course it's a bad thing. Footwear. Nike, for example, is a member of several anti-counterfeiting organizations around the world and actively supports intellectual property legislation, consumer electronics, clothes and other apparel and accessories. So there's a long list of things that are targets every year for counterfeiting. We also have a somewhat different topic called unauthorized sales or gray market sales. This is when your product, is sold but through an alternative channel of distribution some way you don't intend it to be sold. So you sell in this channel domestically, and maybe at a different price because it's a different country in this channel internationally. And somebody buys up those internationally targeted products and brings them back into this country and sells them at a different price. It's your product, but not purchased the way you intend it to be done. So those unauthorized party who do this then sell the products far below market price, but unknown to the customer, this is going to come without the support or service or warranty of the original manufacturer. It happened to me in an odd way. I was taking students internationally. My camera was broken by the airlines. They didn't want to deal with it, so I had to buy a new camera because I wanted to take pictures of the students while I was overseas. So I bought a Canon product in Switzerland. Eventually, it had a problem back here in the States. I contacted Canon in the States. They said, you'd have to take that back to the country in which you bought it, sir. I wasn't delighted by their customer service, but they were saying it's not a U.S. distributed product. Even though I bought it legally, it was somewhere else. So certainly, if it's an unauthorized sale, it's going to come without support, service, or warranties. So this is going to hurt the company's revenue and their profit, and of course, if it's extreme, hurts the company's reputation. There is actually an organization globally that deals with this, the World Intellectual Properties Organization, and if at your heart you've been burning to learn more about intellectual property protection and patent protection throughout the world, they actually offer free courses online, and there's a group of my students, and I think I'm in the middle there, but it doesn't matter, at WIPO. So how we protect our, how else do we protect our brand name? What else do we have to worry about? Well, we do have to worry about it becoming so popular it goes generic. That is to say, people begin to use our brand name to refer generically to the product, and suddenly we don't have patent protection on it anymore. And that has certainly happened over the years. For example, all of these were once brand names. Trampoline, aspirin, shredded wheat, thermos, linoleum, yo-yo, escalator were all brand names at one point in time. They are no longer protected by patent because they become generic. How do you prevent that from happening? Well, It happens when there's no simple generic word available. And so people start using your brand name to describe it. What do you call an escalator if you don't call it an escalator? A upward and downward moving automated staircase. What are you going to call it? What's the other name for an escalator? Well, there is no other name that we know, so people refer to it. You promote it, but you promote it too well. So people start using your brand name to refer to everything in the product category. Kleenex has to be careful because people often begin to refer to all tissues as Kleenex. So they want you to use the name Kleenex tissue. So we're going to protect it by certainly indicating that it's trademarked, having that little R in the circle, T in the circle. This is a little funny story, true story. When we came out in 2010 with the new Kent State Centennial logo, the initial version, they forgot to put an R up there. It was not. Didn't show that it was registered. You would say to yourself, "Who's worried about Kent State being a registered trademark?" We actually found universities in China selling Kent State degrees. Now again, it was hard to fight that anyhow, but you want to show that you have a registered trademark. So they had to come back and do that in that logo. So indicate that you're trademarked. Use the brand with the generic term, so Dacron polyester, Kleenex tissues, to emphasize you have a brand name for that generic, for that general product category. And of course the ever popular sue. Go out, make sure that you're suing to show that you protect your brand name. And occasionally we hear that that good family fun-oriented company, Disney, occasionally goes out and sues some poor child care center somewhere because they put Minnie Mouse and Mickey Mouse and Goofy on the side of their building. You can't do that. And periodically they have to show that they're defending those copyrighted materials. So, suing. You have to know that someone is cheating, selling your product online. So you have to do online monitoring. Obviously, not everybody is in the special Project Zero from Amazon. So the internet has created opportunities for parties to easily sell their counterfeit goods. Your brand name, not your product, not your profit. So one fix is companies that help you to find the problem. So founded in 1997, NameProtect assists customers, which include leading law firms, Fortune 500 companies, and other businesses worldwide, in meeting the evolving challenges of protecting brand assets in today's global economy. It was acquired by CSC in 2007, but it is a company whose goal is to help you find counterfeit products for sale on the internet. How do we spot this? This could work for you as a consumer as well as a manufacturer. Have you ever seen something online and you look at it and you say, how are they selling it that cheap, whatever the it is? It might not be what you think it is. So the prices are well below acceptable levels. You look on it and there's no contact information. I foolishly myself, and I'm a marketer and an adult, I should know better, bought something off of, I think it was Facebook posting of some kind. And the product came and I looked at the product. There was no contact information, no instructions, no... I didn't use it because who knows what that thing was. Missing service and warranty information, a good hint that it's probably a problem. Inaccurate product descriptions, they don't describe their own product accurately. Probably something wrong there. Products sold on sites that are not registered to the seller. You should always, of course, check and see before you click and buy what the internet address is. Sites with unsecured transactions, you know to look for HTTPS when you go to buy a product. Unsecured transactions are probably not owned by the company. So those are things that can help us to monitor for problems. So let's think about some branding strategies that we might use given everything we know now. One thing we can do is think about the manufacturer or the producer of the product, and they decide that they want to have all of the work that goes with the brand name. So they brand their own product. It's used by very large, well-financed, and well-managed firms who can afford to promote it and protect it. Apple, Amazon, manufacture and have their names on products. We also see it in the branding of fabricating parts. Those are things added to the final product without further processing, so I'm making this thing and I pop in your fabricated part, for example, Dolby. Your headphones, unless they're made by Dolby, may have Dolby in them, but they don't manufacture Dolby. Dolby's a fabricated part, but we know that it's Dolby. So Netflix adds Dolby Vision Center content to its smartphone. So we brand that. In this case, the seller wants to develop a market preference for its branded parts or materials. Anybody know, do we know the name Dolby? I mean, is that something we know? Yeah? Would anybody be encouraged to buy something because it had Dolby? Or not really. Apparently, they don't have a very strong brand image. Okay. It's a good strategy when the product is also a consumer good that's bought for replacement purposes. And people want to know, well, what is this part or piece? It's something that I know, something that I recognize. So the Delco brand battery, I used the Diehard example before. Here's a replacement part for consumer, the Lightning USB cable by Apple. And so people want to know they're getting a good quality product for their replacement. And it's also used when the item is a key part of the finished product. If it's a rivet, we probably don't care what brand it is of rivet. But when it's our sound system, maybe it matters. Middleman brand. So we think about the manufacturer, then the channel member, so wholesaler, retailer. The middleman brands are also known as private labels. Private labeling involves selling products which a business makes under another company's brand. So I manufacture it, I give it to you, it becomes your brand and you sell it. It's widespread among manufacturers. For the businesses that carry these products, private labeling allows them to sell products that they have no way of manufacturing themselves using their unique brand. So I'm Kroger's. I don't have the wherewithal to manufacture every product with the name Kroger's on it. It's just too much. So I use existing food manufacturers, and they produce my product, and I put Kroger's name on them. The hope is that the manufacturer's brand will appeal to loyal customers, while the cost-conscious consumer will buy the less expensive middleman private brands. So Del Monte Corn, Del Monte may have excess capacity when they're manufacturing. They may also agree to produce Kroger's corn. I imagine, although I can't prove it from standing here, that Del Monte corn in the store is more expensive than Kroger's in the store. So loyal Del Monte consumers are willing to pay more for the Del Monte brand. Cost-conscious consumers are willing to buy the Kroger's brand of corn. Vega Coffee sells its product to ice cream manufacturers who use it in their products. So they're selling it through that channel. The middleman may choose to carry only the manufacturer's brands. They don't want to have the responsibilities we've talked about of maintaining their brand. So some grocery stores don't carry their own name. They only carry manufacturer's brands. Others take on those branding responsibilities. The middleman may choose, of course, to carry both the producer and their own private label brands. For example, Kroger's carries national brands plus its own brands. They have a tiered private label marketing strategy. The Kroger private brand emphasizes no-frill products at the lowest possible price. They also, though, have Kroger Simple Truth. It's focused on the organic market segment, and they have their private selection, a premium brand that begins to compete with the manufacturer's brand. So they have an actual tiered approach to their private label. In general, if you are a middleman with your own brand, what do you hope to do? We hope to create store loyalty. You want people coming back to get the Kroger brand. And because you're not paying the manufacturer's price, you're getting a discounted price, you hope to get better profit margins on those brands that you're carrying. Something like 60% of retailers say they plan to place more emphasis on private label brands over time for those reasons. If you're a manufacturer, now you've got a head scratch. So what am I going to do if 60% of retailers are planning to carry more private labels? Well, one thing you can do is cut your price, right? So you make your price more like the middleman's price. Or better yet, convince people that your brand is superior. Del Monte corn, man, you don't want that stupid Kroger's corn. It's nothing. It's like our corn. Our corn is wholesomer, tastier, whatever. Prune your product line back so you're not having the high cost of inventory, etc. But this does set up what we call the battle of the brands on the shelf. Which brands are you going to buy? Are you going to buy the store brand, the manufacturer brands? We're battling against each other. I got 4 minutes left, but it is St. Paddy's Day, is it not? I imagine some of us need 4 extra minutes of our day to celebrate. Let's call it a day. It's the end of the material for whatever mini test we're on. I've lost track. Have a happy and safe St. Paddy's Day. See you next week.